This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Havante Chan Resource Center, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Do women experience the business world in a different way or different ways? How? What hurdles stand in their way? What ladders are placed to get them up higher? How do they respond to business challenges, and what can we all learn from them? My guest today is Whitney Johnson, the author of Dare, Dream, Do. Remarkable things happen when you dare to dream. She co-founded Rose Park Advisors, a firm that is focused on identifying investment opportunities. Ms. Johnson is also a corporate speaker and a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review. You were a music major, and music majors traditionally graduate to go into education or part-time education and part-time musician. What led you into the corporate world?
It was a very circuitous route. I had never planned on going into the corporate world. I graduated, as you said, with music from university. And when my husband also graduated, we had gone to New York City so he could pursue his PhD at Columbia University. And so one of us had to put food on the table. He was in school, so I was elected. And because we were in New York, I decided I wanted to work on Wall Street. And so I went from music to Wall Street. But because I had a music degree, I started on the lowest rung of the ladder, which was as a secretary.
Oh, and then from there to become a stock picker.
I did. Very slowly, though. It happened over the course of about 15 years. So I started, as I said, as a secretary. And after about a year, in fact, it was funny because I would go to work every day and I would see all these people, you know, next to me, all these up-and-coming stockbrokers. This was really the era of Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, telling people to throw down their pom-poms and get in the game and buy this stock. And I had been a cheerleader in high school, so I was sort of offended initially. But then one day I thought, you know what, I need to throw down my pom-poms and get in my game. And so I started taking finance courses at night in accounting and economics, and eventually started moving up the ladder from secretary to investment banker. And then I moved to become an equity analyst where, as you said, I began picking stock.
Any relationship between stock picking and music?
I'd say yes and no. The relationship would be that as a musician, we know how to create structure. And I think when you're looking at stock, you're trying to make a story and try to come up with a thesis for why something might be a buy or a sell. And so I do think the musicianship helps with that. Musicianship requires something very intuitive and a feel for the music. And I do think that as a stock picker, you actually start to see that stocks in the market generally have personalities or something that you feel and is very intuitive. And the best stock pickers not only do the analysis of a company and build a financial model and construct a story, but they also have an intuitive feel for whether or not a stock will go up or down.
I know I'm asking you to generalize, you know, having been in business and that you also are a consultant to women entrepreneurs. On the whole, how do you think women experience the business world?
It's a very different experience for women than it is for men. I remember a conversation with a male CEO friend a few years ago where we were having this fantastic conversation, and about halfway into it, he said to me, "There's a woman that you must meet." And I said to him, "Well, I'd love to meet her, and because I love meeting interesting people." And then I said, "Any men you'd like me to meet?" And he looked at me and he said, "Well, aren't you happily married?" And we both chuckled. And then we realized the problem, because if you're a woman, you may be very relational and very good at networking, but what you find very quickly is that women only introduce women to other women, and men just tend to, out of habit, only introduce women to other women. And the problem is that men tend to still have the power in the business world. And so if they have a Rolodex of 500 people, but only 50 of those are women, then the women are very limited to the people that they're going to meet. Meeting people allows you to get things done. So it's a very different experience for women typically than it is for men.
Well, this example I find is quite interesting in how men kind of think of other business women. How else do you feel women are treated in the business world?
I think oftentimes women are not perceived as being as competent as men are. There's been a lot of research that has been done which has indicated that a woman has to be 2.5 times more competent for a man just to be on equal footing. And I certainly know that I've experienced that where I've been in situations where I was, again, much, much more competent than another man, and he was much younger than I was, and yet we were still basically considered on equal footing. And so you can usually bet that if you meet a woman and she is in sort of middle management and doing, you know, she's actually probably very good. These are hurdles she's had to jump have been much, much higher.
How do you explain that in the context of the fact that in the West, even in Malaysia, there are more women graduating from universities than men?
Well, great question. And I think the answer is that school is not work. And so women are graduating more, but the things that we're learning to do in school are not the skills that we need in order to succeed at work. So, for example, in school, women learn to only raise our hands when we're called on. For example, when I was in third grade, I raised my hand because my teacher had spelled on the board T-H-E-Y apostrophe E-R. If you're familiar with English, you know that she misspelled the word, that it should have been T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. So I raised my hand, Mrs. Smirker, you spelled this word wrong, thinking she was going to be so proud of my excellent spelling and keen observation, but instead, she actually reprimanded me for being a smart mouth. Now, that didn't work for me at school, of raising my hand and jumping into the conversation, but in the workplace, in order to succeed, you have to be willing to just jump into the fray, have an opinion, be able to influence authority, and eventually even become the authority. So that's just one example of how women have traditionally responded, and what does well for them in school doesn't necessarily translate to doing well in the workplace.
I mean, the example you've given has triggered something in my mind in that, you know, different adjectives are used to describe competent male and competent female. I mean, a competent male would say, like, and he's doing his job well, and that he's assertive, he's strong. But when we talk about women who are strong, the adjectives aren't always so flattering.
You're being very polite. That is exactly correct. In fact, there's a piece of research that was done, a case study that was done out of Stanford Business School, where they had done a case study on a woman. Her name was Heidi Rose. And then they took off her name and they put a man's name to Howard Rosen. And what was so fascinating, exact same person, just a different name, the people responded very, very differently. They did, you know, sort of, he's ambitious and yes, he's tough, but I'd love to work with him. With her, it was, well, yeah, she's kind of ambitious and I'm not sure I would like to work with her. So yeah, there's definitely, for a female, there's a social cost to being assertive. And so there's this sort of very narrow swath of behavior that's acceptable for a woman that she has to figure out if she wants to be successful.
How, on the whole, have women traditionally responded in the business world?
I think initially there is denial. It's interesting because just a couple of weeks ago, I lectured at Harvard Business School about the 7 things that I wish I had known when I graduated from college and entered the workforce. And one of the points that I raised was, I wish I had known that the glass ceiling is real. And the students looked at me like, nah, it's not real. And I said, okay, I understand that you don't believe that it's real, and that's fine. But at some point, you're going to discover that, in fact, it is real, and I want you to know it is. Now, it doesn't mean you don't have to do something about it. But knowing that it's real allows you to say, okay, it's not me, it's the institution, it's systemic bias, that's not fair, I'll be sad for a day or two, now I need to move on. And I think that's an important thing for women to realize, is that we've sort of tried to deny that things are different for us, but as soon as we acknowledge them, then we can say, all right, there's some things I can fix, there's some things I can't fix, so how do I go about fixing the things that I can?
Do you think it's different in America as opposed to maybe some other countries? I'm raising this question simply because, you know, there's no woman president in your history. England, you have Margaret Thatcher, and Australia, Germany, India, South Korea. Is that more of an American issue, you think?
That's a great question. You know, I haven't studied how the women in each of these various countries have come into power. I think I'll only speak to the United States, but, you know, here in the United States, where people are elected and very much the people that we elect, we are projecting onto them, you know, their archetypes, who we want to be and how we believe men should be and women should be. And so, for example, you know, we like men to be typically a little bit naughty and to be strong and then to be sensitive as well. And so you see that with President Obama, where he was able to do all of those things remarkably well. Where Romney, I think, actually suffered in our country was that he was very strong, but he didn't have a soft side. Hillary Clinton is very strong, but she didn't show the feminine side, and people could not deal with that. So again, I don't know about other countries per se. I think Margaret Thatcher actually came into power via a very, very small group of people. But I think until we shift a little bit, or our women in power are both masculine and feminine, I think we're still going to be a while before a woman actually gets elected.
I would like to talk to you about what successful women entrepreneurs are doing. Whitney Johnson, speaker, author, and contributor to the Harvard Business Review. She also consults on women entrepreneurship, more of her observations of the world of work and women's contributions to it. This is Her Vantage on Resource Center on BFM 89.9, the business station. This is Her Vantage on Resource Center. This afternoon, I have Whitney Johnson online with me. After years as a first-rate stock picker on Wall Street, she moved to the world of helping investment funds find the right kind of investments. She also consults on business issues. What are women entrepreneurs doing well?
There are a lot of things that we're doing well. I would say the first is that we're learning to not just listen, but also to start talking, to not just be seen, but also heard. And it is a very hard thing for us to do, but we are learning to do it. And let me explain what I mean. Women actually are taught from a very young age that we're only feminine within the context of a relationship or giving something to someone else. And so when we speak up, we're by definition taking something as opposed to giving attention. And so one of the things that we're learning to do is overcome that sense that it's not proper for us and to speak up. Now, I'll give you an example where that illustrates how difficult it is. In a prior life, work life, I was an equity analyst, and I was working at Merrill Lynch. I had taken a group of investors, all male, down to Brazil. Mostly, I think, U.S. citizens, and we had gone to visit a number of telecom companies that day. And after the day, we were debriefing, eating a little bit of dinner, and the conversation turned to a company called América Móvil, which is one of the largest cellular companies in the world. And I covered this stock, so I built a financial model, I knew management very well, I was absolutely the expert. And so each of these different analysts, gentlemen, you know, from large institutions like T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, are giving their opinions about this stock. And they turned to me and they said, well, what do you think? And I found myself as if I were struck dumb, I mean literally dumb, could not say anything. And I thought, what is going on? And so the thing that had happened is that oftentimes women were, again, socialized to not speak up. And also there's been research done that when women are in the minority, we aren't willing to speak up in the same way that men are when we're in the minority. And so I realized that in those situations, I have to learn how to begin to speak up, to stop listening and keep talking. And I do that by practicing talking shop. And you'll notice, at least I have noticed, that a lot of the women that are in generations succeeding mine, who are in their 20s and their 30s, are learning to really speak up and articulate their views. And I think that that's going to be very, very important, because when you speak up, it changes the entire equation in terms of being able to get things done.
As more and more women become entrepreneurs and starting their own businesses, what kinds of values, what kinds of positive things are they bringing to bear into their companies?
One of them is that women tend to be relational, meaning we tend to focus more on connections between people, and we see connections where others don't. Nietzsche once said, invisible threads are the strongest ties. Women tend to be able to see these invisible threads. And because women actually have been marginalized and left out of internal power structures, typically we've learned to build networks external to an organization, which remains intact when they leave. Now, I'll give you actually a more specific example. When I was at Merrill Lynch as a stock picker, one of the things I found is that I would try to get things done within my organization with the sales force, et cetera, and oftentimes they wouldn't necessarily want to work with me, so I disintermediated them and went directly to the client, whether that was Fidelity or Wellington, et cetera. And so I was building a network so that when I decided that I wanted to move from what is now Bank of America to Merrill Lynch, my network wasn't just within a company, it was outside of a company. So I've been playing in a much larger sandbox. And so when I moved, it was much easier. And there's been research that's been done is that women have a much easier time changing jobs than men do, precisely because of those external networks. And obviously, networks are incredibly valuable. And they allow women, I think, to get things done, both from a formal and informal power perspective. So we're very relational. We see connections. We know how to do informal power. And I think all of those are very key, especially in a world that has become much flatter and much less hierarchical. They're important skills to have. And the last thing I would say on that is that because we build networks outside of an organization, we know how to play where no one is playing, to create markets and opportunities that no one else has thought of. And that's what a disruptor does, a disruptive innovator does. They look for opportunities where it would never occur to anyone else to even begin to look.
Do you think women entrepreneurs focus more on the whole company as opposed to looking at the bottom line?
Not necessarily. I think that women tend to sometimes focus on not only the bottom line, but also the people within a company and the relationships within a company. And sometimes that actually gets them in trouble because typically when decisions are being made about remuneration, about bonuses, et cetera, it's all about the bottom line as opposed to what did you do? What are some of the soft skills that you brought in order to build our business? An example from my career, I had a person working for me was terrific, and I decided that it would be great for the firm generally, not for me, to have him move to another area where he could grow and he could contribute in a greater way. Now, that was being completely a team player, but when it came time to get bonuses, they didn't compensate me for that. Mm. So I think one of the things that's important is that women focus on, you know, the overall team, the overall firm, not just the bottom line, but that doesn't always necessarily hold them in good stead.
How would you respond to the comment then that business women need to be more like businessmen and with the emphasis on men?
Well, my answer would be, yes, we do need to be more like men. But I will parry with this, that men need to be more like women to succeed. My view of the world is very much rooted in Jungian psychology, which is that each of us have a psyche that's made up of masculine and feminine characteristics. So the feminine is relatedness and nurturing, male, the ability to wield power and control situations. So women sort of tend toward being the harbor, men the ship. The business spoils tend to go to men that know how to wield power, to control situations. But the really successful business leaders, male business leaders, just like I said about President Obama, are also relational, possessing soft skills. So women, if you flip that on its head, if we're instinctively feminine, we know how to build relationships. We need to develop more masculine in sort of the generic sense of learning to wield power and control situations, to be a ship and not just a harbor. So yes, absolutely, we need to learn to be more like men in that sense, but men need to be more like women. And I think that's part of the reason why you need men and women in a corporation, and the returns increase so substantially when you do have both as opposed to just one gender or another. It's not just a woman-run business or not just male-run business. And so I think that I would agitate and really encourage anybody who's listening to that to think about, if you really want to have a competitive edge, is to employ and involve men and women at the most senior ranks, because that is what will make you successful.
Who are your models?
Well, I have to say right now, Sheryl Sandberg is very much on my mind because I just finished reading her book and writing a piece about her. I think she's done a really terrific job of being able to navigate a very male-dominated world, which is not easy to do. So right now, I'd say she is definitely a role model. There's another woman you probably don't know, but her name is Barbara Corcoran, who was a very successful real estate executive here in the United States and now is involved in a television show called Shark Tank, which is essentially a show for capitalizing early stage businesses. And I think that that is a really terrific and exciting thing to do. So those are two people I admire and look to as how to navigate the workplace as a woman.
In terms of people who are entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs, any models that you have?
You know what's interesting is some of the people I'm going to mention, you're not going to necessarily know who they are because they're smaller businesses. But there's one company here in the United States called Red Stamp. She's been around about 10 years. Their app that they have is a 1% app in the iTunes store. And what they do is they allow people to provide correspondence, you know, on their iPhone. So very quickly, I want to send you a thank you note. I can do that. And what I love about her is that her business grew out of her love for correspondence and her love for helping people stay connected to the people that they care about. But it's also very much blended with her family, who she is, what she cares about. And so to me, that is the best entrepreneur, is someone who is able to care about people, love their family, attend to them, but also attend to their business and career and building something that employs people and also has a bottom line that's profitable. So her name is Erin Newkirk, and I do quite admire her.
Whitney Johnson, author of Dare, Dream, Do, Remarkable Things Happen When You Dare to Dream. Music major who graduated to Wall Street and then to community building initiatives featuring global investment, journalism, academic, religious and media icons, to name a few. She started blogging 2006, and if you want to read more about her thoughts about business, just Google her. Inc. magazine named her as one of the 12 people to follow on Twitter in 2012. This is Her Vantage on Resource Center, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.